Welcome to I Think Therefore iPod, a podcast on all things Apple and beyond. March 21st, 2006. Hi everybody and welcome to the show. First of all, I'm sorry I haven't been able to release a podcast in the last couple of days. I've been a bit inundated with work. I'm actually running on 1.5 hours of sleep at the moment, but, you know, it's only 9:20 p.m. It's still early. Anyway, I've got quite a lot of things I want to talk about today. First of all, I want to talk about a piece of news that's been on everybody's mind recently. After that, I'm going to talk about GarageBand, and I'm going to tell you about a couple of the things that I've been doing whilst playing around with it. When I'm done with GarageBand, I'd like to discuss iTunes, and I want to cover a couple of issues, including rating songs and the question of an iTunes movie. And finally, I'd like to talk about a controversial piece of legislation that's been proposed in France, followed by a brief note on one of my favorite pieces of software of all time. But before I get into these topics, I'd like to do a brief follow-up to my last podcast. Now, in my last episode, I was talking about browsers, and I was explaining to you why Safari was still my favorite OS X browser, even though great alternatives like Camino and Firefox are available. And one of the things I was talking about was how well Safari integrated with the operating system and with other Apple applications. And there's actually one major feature of Safari that I forgot to mention that is definitely one of the main things keeping me hooked onto it. And that is the built-in dictionary. If you're not familiar with this feature, basically what it is the dictionary that comes with OS X built into Safari. And the way that this works is, if you hover your cursor over a piece of text in Safari, and you hold down Command-Control-D, a little window will pop up with the definition of it. And you can switch between dictionary and thesaurus. And one of the cool things is that if you keep holding Command and Control, and you move the cursor over different words, you'll get a definition for every word that you place your cursor over. This is definitely one of my favorite features of Safari. I use it all the time to look up words, and it's just another example of Safari's excellent integration with other software on OS X. What's even better is that Safari isn't the only piece of software that has this feature built in. Most of the software that comes with OS X incorporates this functionality, so you can use the built-in dictionary with Mail, with Address Book, TextEdit, iCal, and even some third-party Cocoa apps use it, my favorite being Adium, the chat client. So let's move on now and talk about a piece of news that's been sweeping across the Mac community. And that piece of news would be Windows XP booting on the new Intel Macs. I wrote an article about this on my website, but if you haven't already heard, basically what happened is there was a contest that offered prize money of just under $14,000 to anybody who could get Windows XP to boot legally on one of the new Intel Macs. And the contest was recently won by two users known as Narf and Blanca. And what they basically did was they figured out how to get the new Intel Macs to dual boot into either OS X or Windows XP. Now, I don't want to delve too deeply into the technicalities of how they did this, and I must admit that I don't fully understand the process myself, but basically it involves partitioning your Mac's hard drive, with part of it being reserved for Windows and part of it being reserved for OS X, and then using a Windows PC to prepare and burn a copy of Windows that you can then install onto your Intel Mac. You can find a lot more information and detail on this, and even download the bootloader if you want, from the contest website, which can be found at onmac.net, and I'll be sure to provide a link to this on my website. One thing to note is that whilst Windows XP will now boot on your Intel Mac, it won't run perfectly because a lot of the driver issues haven't been solved yet. But on their website and on their forums, drivers are being updated almost daily, and sometimes even hourly. So if you're interested in this, by all means go check it out. Now, you've got to give these guys a lot of credit, because getting Windows to run on a Mac was no easy task. The debugging at every step along the way must have been a real pain. And I read an interview with one of the contest winners who basically said that every time Windows crashed or would reboot, they would have to figure out from scratch what was wrong or why it wasn't working. So well done to them. And I must admit that they've actually created a really nice dual boot screen. And if you haven't seen how this works, there are videos of this floating around all over the internet. And I'll put a link to at least one of them on my website. Now, as cool as this is, and I definitely don't want to take anything away from these guys, I still don't like the idea of booting my Mac into Windows XP. And if anything, the one thing that their success tells me is that Windows can now run natively on these Intel chips without having to be run under emulation. And so what I'd like to see is something like an updated version of Virtual PC that would allow me to run Windows XP natively, but within OS X, in an environment like Virtual PC. One of the reasons why Virtual PC was so slow was because the Windows BIOS had to be translated so that it could run on the PowerPC chips. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if Windows XP can now run natively on the Intel chips, then shouldn't it be able to run within OS X without having to be run under emulation, thus speeding it up a lot more? I mean, I would love nothing more than to be able to load up Virtual PC and play FIFA whenever I want to. But I don't want to have to boot into Windows on my Mac. So that's basically been the biggest story in the last couple of days. And if you haven't had a chance to go and check it out yet, I do recommend that you go take a look. Anyways, moving on now. One of the things that this podcast led me to do was to play around with GarageBand a lot more than I have before. And I'll be honest with you, I never really used GarageBand a lot prior to this podcast. I used it occasionally to record the odd track here and there, but I never really delved into it to see exactly what it could do. And I was playing around with it the other day, and I found that you can actually create some pretty nice sounding tracks using only the digital effects and the Apple loops that come with GarageBand. And so basically what I was doing was I was messing around with it and I ended up making my own track. I spent an hour and a half just playing around with settings and testing out different loops. And I must say I was quite pleasantly surprised with the end result. So what I'm going to do now is play the first minute of that track for you. And basically this track was done entirely in GarageBand using only Apple loops and digital effects. And basically this was my first attempt at making anything other than a podcast on GarageBand. So here it is. Check it out. There you go. Pretty cool, eh? Now, there wasn't anything amazing sounding there, and there wasn't anything really high-tech going on either, but I must admit, I was really pleasantly surprised with what GarageBand can do. And to be honest, it's just quite fun to play around with some of the loops and effects that are available in GarageBand. And as that little snippet showed, you can make quite a decent sounding tune by mixing and matching loops without having to put a lot of effort into it. On top of that, you can import MP3s into GarageBand if you want to edit them, simply by clicking and dragging from iTunes, which is another really cool feature. And some of the effects available allow you to alter a track or a vocal recording quite significantly. For example, this is a bit embarrassing, but here we go. I could make my voice sound like this. Simply by adding some echo, reverb, and a vocal transformer. All of this you can access by getting the track's info by pressing Command-I. Now, why you'd want to do something like that is a question I can't answer. You see the kind of things I do for this podcast? Anyways, if you do want to create a track using Apple's loops, the most important things to bear in mind are, first of all, timing and tempo. You want any loops that you pick to be in time with each other. And so you can pick a loop with a tempo of 80 beats per minute and another with 120, and that's fine, they'll still be in time. But don't use one loop that's got a tempo of 85 and another one that's got a tempo of 99, because they'll just be out of time with each other and it'll end up sounding horrible. And another thing to bear in mind is to just keep it simple. So keep your styles consistent and don't overdo it. So a song with 150 tracks and 30 different drum beats playing at once isn't necessarily going to sound that good. Basically, too many tracks can spoil your end result. But by all means, don't take my word for this. Go and play with GarageBand, experiment with different styles, different loops, record into it using your own instruments. Just let your creative juices flow, because it's really, really a fun application. And I kind of wish I'd started playing with it a lot earlier. So, let's talk about iTunes, and I want to talk about rating songs a little bit, because I've always wondered about this feature in iTunes, and to be honest, I've never actually bothered to go around and rate all of my songs, because I always thought, you know, 1,500 tracks, do I really want to go through them one by one and give them a rating out of 5 stars? Well, I did. I spent the weekend, I took a few hours out of my schedule to rate all of the songs in my music library. It actually took me a while to come up with a system of rating my songs, and I had to decide what each star rating would mean. So I came up with this system in the end. 0 stars means that I haven't listened to the song yet, or that it's so bad that I never, ever want to hear it again. 1 star means that I really don't like the song and I don't want to hear it very often. 2 songs means that I'm not a big fan of the song, I could possibly tolerate it from time to time, but not too often. A 3-star song is a song that I like and don't mind listening to, but that I have to be in a certain mood in order to enjoy. A 4-star song is a song that I really like and enjoy listening to most of the time. And the 5-star rating is reserved only for my absolute favorite songs that I love to listen to no matter what my mood is or how often I listen to them. And to be honest, only 2 songs at the moment are rated 5 stars in my library. I actually kind of based my rating system on the way that websites like Macworld and iLounge rate the products that they review, simply because I visit these websites so much that their rating system out of 5 just makes sense to me. And if you've ever been to these sites, you'll notice that they hardly ever award a 5-star rating. But of course, everyone's rating systems will differ, and that's just how my system works. So, the reason I went to all the trouble of rating all my songs was to see whether or not it would make a difference. And I found that it actually did make a big difference, and that there are a number of awesome uses for rating songs. First of all, having a library where every song has a rating is really good for smart playlists. Before I rated all my songs, I had a normal playlist labeled popular, and in this playlist I put hits for parties and generally good songs that I liked. Now, the problem with this was when I got new songs, a lot of the times I either forgot to move the songs I liked to the popular playlist or I simply couldn't be bothered to do so. After rating my songs though, I can use a smart playlist to have all of my top rated songs automatically put into the same playlist, which saves me a lot of time and effort. I don't have to remember which songs I like and which songs I've moved into my popular playlist, which songs I mean to move into that playlist. All I have to do is create a smart playlist that takes all of my songs that are rated 4 stars or higher, and boom, it does everything for me. And of course, smart playlists are Spotlight powered, so they constantly automatically update themselves. After having rated all my songs, I can now create a lot more creative and diverse playlists that serve a lot of specific purposes. So for example, I now have a smart playlist that contains all of my unrated songs. I have a smart playlist that contains my top rated songs that I haven't played recently. So basically how this works is I have songs that are rated 4 stars or higher, But the other condition is that they have to have not been played within the last 2 days. And so what this playlist allows me to do is listen to some of my favorite songs that I haven't heard in a couple of days, which is really great. And finally, since I have multiple iPods, I found that using these new smart playlists also helped enhance that experience too. For example, on my Nano, I can't fit my entire library onto it, so what I do is I only synchronize a certain number of select playlists with it. So what I did was I created a smart playlist that basically included all of the playlists that I synchronize with my Nano. And so what that allows me to do is, when I'm listening to my main iPod, my 20GB third generation, what I can do is go to this smart playlist, which I've named Nano, and basically play my 20GB iPod as if it were my Nano. Now, obviously, I could have done this without having to have rated all my songs, but to be honest, if I hadn't gone through the whole process, I wouldn't have gotten around to making this playlist. So basically, rating songs turned out to be a lot more useful than I thought it would be, and there are so many different kinds of playlists that you can create once you've gone through your library and rated all your songs. So if you want more control and diversity in the kinds of smart playlists that you can create, I do recommend taking some time and just rating all of your songs, if you don't do that already. I'd like to now talk about the idea of iTunes movie downloads. I discussed this on my website a couple of days ago, and basically what happened was Apple had their first full-length feature film available on the iTunes Music Store, and this was High School Musical from the Disney Channel, no surprise there. What happened was the movie was originally priced at $1.99, but Apple removed it from the Music Store and put it back up with a revised price of $9.99. Now, I'm all for the idea of iTunes movie downloads. I think it's the obvious next step given the success of their music video and television show sales, but I think an interesting point was made on Dignation a couple of days ago. The point was that we already have a way of purchasing or renting movies, unlike TV. We can go down to Blockbuster or HMV and buy or rent a DVD, for example. With television, unless you set up a TiVo or a VCR, you'd have to watch the shows when they were broadcast. And so what the iTunes Music Store did was they gave us a way of accessing television shows that we wanted to watch at any time we wanted. But the thing is, we can already do that with movies. And so I think this is a pretty good point. The question being, would you pay $9.99 for a movie being downloaded onto your computer at what is probably a much lower resolution than a DVD, for example, and without any of the extras or additional features? Now, I do think there is a market for iTunes movie downloads, but to be honest, watching a movie on an iPod or on your computer is nowhere near as enjoyable as watching it on your television. TV shows and video podcasts, well, you can watch them on your iPod, you can watch them on your computer, but not a full-length movie. And so, what I would really like to see is something like an updated Airport Express that allows you to stream the movies that you download from iTunes to your television where you can watch them. Kind of like the new sharing features on Front Row. Personally, it would probably take something like that to make a $9.99 movie download from the iTunes Music Store seem genuinely worth the money. And thankfully, with things like the new Front Row and the iPod Hi-Fi, Apple does seem to be making steps in this direction. But like almost everything that Apple does, we'll have to wait and see. Now here's another story that's been making headlines recently. France apparently wants to introduce a new piece of legislation, which I think has already been approved and is awaiting the vote. And basically what this legislation would do is it would make it legal to remove the digital rights management from files that have DRM, such as songs that you download from the iTunes Music Store. And on top of that, they want to force companies that use DRM, such as Apple and Sony, to basically reveal the technologies behind their digital rights management so that people can create intercompatible devices. Apple, in response, has come out publicly and declared that they're not happy with this. They've called it a state-sponsored form of piracy. And a lot of analysts believe that should the law get passed, Apple would rather pull out of the French market than comply with it. And I, for one, also subscribe to this view. I think it's a really stupid idea from the French government, and this is why. First of all, DRM doesn't actually stop people from playing music that they download from the iTunes Music Store on other devices. Now, I know it's illegal to do so, but it's not like it's hard to get your iTunes music to play on a non-iPod device. For a long time now, we've known that all you have to do is burn your music onto a CD and then re-rip it back into iTunes. And basically, all the French government wants to do is to make this legal. The thing is, removing DRM from your files and playing it on non-iPod devices might be illegal, but it's so difficult to enforce that introducing a law like this isn't really going to make a big difference to the way people use their MP3 players or their iPods. And anyway, most of the people who do use the iTunes Music Store are people who own iPods. In terms of the bigger picture, though, what France is basically doing is making a practice legal in their country that is illegal in most other countries. And the reason removing DRM is illegal in most countries is to protect copyright. So what this could open the door to is a legal form of piracy, whereby people take protected data, protected music, protected movies, take them to France, remove the DRM, and distribute them legally. And so, as Apple said, this is basically a state-sponsored endorsement of piracy. Now, I'm not taking this view to protect Apple either. It's not like people are going to stop buying iPods if you make this practice legal, because it's pretty well accepted that it's iPod sales that turn people to the iTunes Music Store, and not the other way around. And Apple themselves have acknowledged that making this practice legal would probably increase iPod sales, as people would be able to play other forms of protected media on their iPods that they might not otherwise have been able to. Now, the reason I think that Apple would be more likely to pull out of the French market than comply with this law if it were passed is the fact that this law tries to force the details of DRM technology to be revealed. And I do not see Apple doing that. I don't see them releasing their DRM technology to a third party, to the public, so that people can develop iPod-compatible devices. Especially because people could go to France, acquire this information, and take it to other countries where it's not available. I just don't see them doing that, and I just see this as a really pointless and stupid move by the French government. Now, I could be wrong, but I just would not be surprised at all if the iTunes Music Store were taken away from the French market should this legislation be passed, and that probably would not go down well with French iPod owners. But anyway, this is a story that I will be keeping an eye on, and I'd like to see how it develops. And the final thing I want to talk about today is one of my favorite applications of all time, called Quicksilver. Now, if you don't have a copy of Quicksilver on your Mac already, or if you haven't heard of it, I do recommend that you go and pick up a copy right now. It's free, and I'll put a link to it on my website. And basically, what this application does is it allows you to instantly launch things like applications, bookmarks, and run scripts. Now, some of you might be saying, this sounds like Spotlight, doesn't it? Yes and no. Spotlight is very good for finding things. It's great for finding documents, images, PDFs, you name it. Now, what Quicksilver does is it acts more like a launcher application. So instead of giving you a giant list when you type something into it, what it does is it looks for the most probable match to what you're typing. And this makes it a lot quicker, and it's also surprisingly accurate. And so the fact that I can now launch iMovie, for example, by pressing Option and Space, which is the hotkey I've assigned to Quicksilver, typing IM and then pressing Enter, is absolutely brilliant. It saves me so much time. And the great thing about Quicksilver is that it learns your usage habits very quickly. So, for example, if I use Photoshop more than I use Photo Booth, when I invoke Quicksilver and I type photo, it'll give me Photoshop first and foremost. And if I actually want to launch Photo Booth, all I have to do is press the arrow keys and select it, and boom, there we go. So when Apple said that Spotlight would revolutionize the way you use your Mac and make it the case that you would never really have to access your Finder again, they were right to an extent, but it takes something like Quicksilver to really make that the case. And since I have my hotkeys for Spotlight and Quicksilver right next to each other, I use Command Space for Spotlight and Option Space for Quicksilver, I can now launch applications and find things instantly. And so I really don't use the Finder very often now. except when I have to do something like move a file from one folder to another. So Quicksilver is a really good complement to Spotlight, not a replacement for it. Quicksilver for launching things, and Spotlight for finding things. And I must say that these two together have really revolutionized and changed the way that I use my Mac. So I'd really recommend that you go and check Quicksilver out if you haven't already done so. And if you like it, the one thing that's almost essential to getting the most out of it is to make sure that it launches at startup. So that's just about it for this episode. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to visit my website at ithinkthereforeipod.blogspot.com. See you next time!